Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're stepping away from, the usual topics of strategy and markets.
Yeah, we're going somewhere much deeper.
Exactly. Right into arguably the most complex system there is, our own nervous system and this whole experience of safety. We're tackling something I think everyone experiences. We call it the great safety paradox.
It really is a paradox, isn't it?
Wow.
That feeling. You, listening right now, you could be perfectly safe physically, in your car, your desk.
Logically, everything's fine.
Right. But your body, it might suddenly decide it's red alert time, your heart starts pounding, breath gets shallow, maybe that knot in your stomach appears.
Or just this urge to, I don't know, run or hide somewhere. Even when your thinking brain, your cortex, is saying, hey, relax, there's no tiger here.
That disconnect is key. It tells us loud and clear that our felt sense of safety, that deep gut feeling, it operates on a completely different level than our conscious thoughts.
And that's really our mission for this deep dive, isn't it?
It is. We're drawing from a really insightful source today, a white paper that lays out the multimodal present moment framework, or MMPM.
Okay.
And this framework, well, it gives us a kind of shortcut, a way to understand what some call the neurosystemic approach. How do we actually talk to these deeper systems?
So we're exploring how to connect directly with those, let's call them primitive emotional systems. The goal isn't to think our way out of feeling anxious or unsafe.
Which, let's be honest, rarely works in the moment.
Right. Instead, we want to learn how to speak their language, the language of the body, of sensation, to actually help recalibrate how they respond, like generating tiny updates.
Exactly. Think of it like finding the operating system beneath the user interface and learning how to input a new command, something like, okay, system, this sensation, it doesn't automatically equal danger anymore.
Okay, let's dive into that foundational idea. If logic fails us in those moments, if our cortex, the part that uses language and reasons things out, is sort of offline, what part is running the show? Where's the decision being made?
That's happening much deeper down in the subcortical regions. These are the ancient evolutionary bedrock system.
Billions of years old, right?
Absolutely. They evolved for one primary reason, immediate survival. And critically, they don't understand words, logic, spreadsheets, none of that. Their language is pure physiology.
So if I'm telling myself I am safe, I am calm, but my heart is racing, I'm basically sending a nicely formatted email.
To a system that only reads telegraphs written in heartbeats and muscle tension. Precisely.
Okay, that makes sense.
These subcortical systems, they're pattern detectors. They predict based on sensory input. And they only update their, let's say, worldview when they get new undeniable sensory proof that contradicts their current prediction.
So if the physical feeling, the tight chest, the quick breath signals danger, no amount of positive self-talk is going to overwrite that signal at that deep level.
Not directly, no. The evidence has to be felt physically.
To really grasp the power here, we have to talk about Jake Panksepp's work. Effective neuroscience, he kind of gave us the map, didn't he?
He really did. Panksepp identified these seven core emotional motivational systems. They're hardwired into all mammals, basically. Foundational platforms for, well, everything, survival, connection.
And what are they?
He named them seeking, rage, fear, lust, care, panic, grief, and play.
And importantly, these aren't just vague feelings, they're actual biological circuits in the brain.
That's crucial. They are specific networks of neurons designed to drive specific behaviors and feelings. So that sudden wave of anxiety or dread that comes out of nowhere, that's likely the fear system activating its defense program. It's a super fast assessment saying something's wrong. And it often comes with that urge to flee or freeze.
Okay, and what about that deep ache you feel sometimes, like profound loneliness or loss?
Panksepp linked that to the panic grief system. It's also called the separation distress system. It evolved to keep young mammals, bonded and close to their caregivers for safety.
So that feeling is literally the system crying out for connection.
Yes. It's screaming, warning, disconnected, need connection for survival. And understanding these are distinct biological engines is vital because, well, you can't calm the fear system in the same way you soothe the panic grief system. They need different inputs.
It's quite powerful to reframe these not as like personal failings, but as ancient survival tools just doing their job. maybe a bit too enthusiastically sometimes.
Exactly. And Mark Solms, another neuroscientist, took this even further. He proposed that maybe consciousness itself doesn't just arise from the thinking cortex, but it emerges as the felt experience of these powerful subcortical states interacting with the body and the world around us. We feel, therefore, we are conscious in a way.
Wow. So consciousness is the feeling of these engines running.
That's the idea. And it connects perfectly to our next piece, Antonio Damasio and his somatic marker hypothesis. He really cemented this brain-body connection and emotion.
How did Damasio see that connection? What was his main point?
He flipped the script on how we usually think about it. We often assume threat happens.
Yeah.
Brain feels anxious. Body reacts. Damasio argued it's more like threat happens. Body shifts into a specific physiological state, like racing heart, tight muscles. Brain reads that bodily state. We consciously feel that state as an emotion, like anxiety.
So the emotion is the bodily state, and the feeling is our awareness of that state.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
That tightness in your chest. It isn't just a result of anxiety. It's a core component of the anxiety itself. The brain and body are one unified system in this process.
Which means if we want to change the feeling, we have to change the bodily state, address the somatic marker.
Precisely. You have to intervene at the level of the body. That brings us to the third key framework for understanding this, Stephen Porges and polyvagal theory. This gives us the hierarchy of how our nervous system responds to safety and threat.
The operating manual for that internal scanner, Porges coined a great term for this, didn't he? Neuroception.
Yes, neuroception. Think of it as your nervous system's subconscious surveillance system. It's constantly scanning below the level of conscious thought, both your environment and your internal bodily state for cues. Is it safe here, or is there danger?
And it's doing this all the time, whether we realize it or not.
All the time. You might consciously think, I'm fine, but your neuroception could pick up on a subtle change in someone's tone of voice or even an internal sensation and start shifting you towards a defensive state without you even knowing why.
So when that subconscious radar detects something, a potential threat, or maybe even just uncertainty what happens, how does the system respond?
It tends to follow a predictable hierarchy based on evolution. The ideal state, the goal, is the ventral vagal complex. This is Porges' social engagement system.
That's the safe and social state.
Exactly. When we're here, we feel safe, connected, calm, curious. Our face is expressive. Our voice has melody. This is where we learn, heal, bond. It's our physiological home base.
Okay, that's where we want to be. What happens if neuroception flags a challenge?
If it senses a challenge that requires energy, but isn't necessarily life-threatening, the system shifts down into the sympathetic branch. This is the classic fight or flight response.
Mobilization.
Right. Heart rate up, muscles tense, ready for action. Useful for escaping danger or meeting a challenge, but very energy intensive.
And then there's the oldest, most extreme response.
If the threat feels overwhelming, inescapable, life-threatening, the system drops into the most primitive state, the dorsal vagal complex. This is shutdown or freeze.
Like playing dead?
Essentially. Metabolism plummets, heart rate slows way down, breathing becomes shallow. Often there's a feeling of numbness or dissociation. It's the last resort when fight or flight aren't possible. And it's a very isolating, immobilized state.
Understanding this hierarchy really shows how those emotional engines, like fear or panic, when they fire strongly, can hijack the whole system, pulling us out of that safe ventral vagal state into either high alert or shutdown.
Absolutely. They dictate which level of the hierarchy we land on.
Okay, so we've got these powerful, ancient emotional engines. They're constantly getting feedback from the body via neuroception and shifting us up and down this polyvagal ladder. The real problem starts when they start making bad calls, right?
Exactly. When the system starts interpreting safety as danger, that's when we see chronic anxiety, dysregulation, that feeling of being constantly on edge.
What causes them to start misfiring like that?
Often it's past experiences, things like trauma, chronic stress, maybe difficult early life experiences. They can essentially reprogram these survival systems.
So the fear system, for instance, might learn that the world is fundamentally unsafe.
Right. It stays hyperreactive, constantly scanning, seeing threats, even when, objectively, the situation is safe. The danger might have passed years ago, but the system hasn't gotten the memo. It's stuck in alarm mode.
And what happens to the other systems, the ones associated with feeling good or engaged?
That's a crucial point. When survival systems like fear or panic are chronically overactive, the systems needed for thriving, like seeking, which drives curiosity and exploration, or play, which signals safety and connection, often get suppressed.
Why? Too risky.
The nervous system deems them non-essential, maybe even dangerous, when the primary directive is stay vigilant, survive. So you end up feeling stuck, maybe numb, lacking motivation, always waiting for the other shoe to drop.
This leads us to a really fascinating concept that explains why this pattern gets so stuck. Predictive coding, the idea that the brain isn't just reacting, it's predicting.
Yes, this is huge. The brain is fundamentally a prediction machine. Its main job, in a way, is to constantly guess what sensory information is coming next, to minimize surprise and operate efficiently.
How does it do that?
It maintains what's called a prior. Think of it as a baseline assumption or belief about the world or about a specific situation. This concept is really central, thanks to researchers like Carl Friston.
Can you give an example, a healthy versus an unhealthy prior?
Sure. A healthy prior, maybe learned through safe experiences, could be something like, generally the world is safe and unexpected sounds are usually harmless. But a maladaptive prior, maybe formed during ongoing stress or trauma, might be, the world is dangerous, sudden changes signal threat, connection is unreliable.
And this prior isn't necessarily a conscious thought.
No, often it's held deep in the subcortex. It's an implicit, embodied expectation.
So if the prior is the world is dangerous, the brain anticipates danger. And then what?
It actually starts to filter incoming sensory data to confirm that prediction. It's almost like it's looking for evidence that it's right.
A self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. The brain predicts danger, so it might subtly trigger the physiological state of danger, a little muscle tension, slightly faster heart rate. Then the subcortical systems read that internal state and say, see, I told you, danger.
And the conscious feeling of anxiety is just the result of this loop.
It's the readout. It's the conscious awareness of this prediction playing out and confirming itself through the body.
Okay, that explains why just telling yourself I'm safe often feels completely useless.
Right, because the conscious thought, the affirmation, is trying to argue with a deeply held, embodied prediction that's being constantly reinforced by physical sensations.
The thinking mind doesn't have the security clearance to change that deep level prior.
Pretty much. Cognitive approaches try to reason with systems that operate on the logic of sensation and physiology. They don't, by themselves, restructure those underlying predictive models built on sensory statistics. It's the wrong tool for the job.
So if the root of the problem is this maladaptive physiological prediction error happening below conscious awareness,
then the solution has to intervene at that same level. It needs to be sensory, physiological. We need to give the system new, believable physical data. And that right there is the beauty and the core idea behind the MMPM framework. It's designed precisely to speak that language, to communicate directly with the subcortex.
How does it do that? How does it get the message through?
It works by intentionally creating a prediction error, a moment where the old prediction, this feeling danger, clashes with new incoming sensory data, this feeling plus this safety signal.
Okay, unpack that. The safety loop. How does it create that clash or error without just trying to suppress the original feeling, which we know doesn't work?
The key is you don't try to suppress the difficult sensation. You acknowledge it. The subcortex makes its prediction. Tightness in chest ixoparously. Then simultaneously, you introduce clear, undeniable sensory evidence of safety.
Like what?
Like deliberately taking a long, slow exhale. Or placing a warm hand gently on your chest. The system now gets two contradictory inputs at once. Tight chest, prediction, danger, and slow exhale, warm touch, evidence, safety cut.
Ah, so it creates a mismatch. The old equation is broken.
Exactly. The system registers this discrepancy. It's like, wait a second, the danger signal is here, but so is a strong safety signal.
Yeah.
The old rule doesn't fit this data. It's forced to update its model just a tiny bit, nudging it towards recognizing that the internal sensation can exist alongside safety.
You're essentially teaching it through direct physical experience that activation doesn't automatically mean catastrophe. That's a fundamental relearning.
It is. And because we know from Panksepp that different emotional engines respond to different things, MMPM emphasizes using specific, targeted, multimodal cues. It's not one size fits all.
Right tools for the right engine. Okay, let's make this practical. If someone feels that sharp mobilizing energy of the fear system, kicking in what safety signals speak its language.
Fear responds well to things that actively engage the ventral vagal brake, the calming system. Top of the list, the long, slow exhale, making the out-breath noticeably longer than the in-breath, is a direct physiological signal to slow down.
Simple but powerful. What else?
Pair that with gentle self-touch. Maybe resting a hand softly on your own arm or thigh. This activates specific nerve fibers, see tactile efferents, which are linked to social bonding and soothing. They send calming messages straight up to the brain.
And visually, we often get tunnel vision when scared.
We do. The amygdala fires more when we have a narrow, focused gaze. So the counter is a soft, panoramic gaze. Gently widen your field of vision, taking in the whole room, the periphery, without focusing hard on any one thing. This tends to reduce that amygdala activity.
Okay, fear is about downregulating high alert. What about that deeper ache of panic grief, that feeling of separation or emptiness? What soothes that system?
That system is fundamentally about connection and attachment. So the signals need to evoke soothing, presence, warmth. Placing a warm hand directly over your heart or center of your chest can be very powerful. It taps into those attachment circuits.
Physical warmth and contact.
Yes, also sound. Humming gently or making a low, soft tone. The vibration in your chest and throat actually stimulates branches of the vagus nerve, promoting calm. And finally, gentle, rhythmic movement, like very subtle rocking side to side. It mimics the soothing rhythms of early caregiving.
Makes sense. Now, what if the issue isn't too much activation, but not enough? Feeling shut down, numb, maybe that seeking system is offline.
Right. If you're kind of stuck in a low energy freeze or shut down, you need to gently reactivate exploration, but without pressure. The key is gentle. Re-engage seeking through simple sensory exploration.
How?
Focus on texture, scent, or novelty right here, right now. Maybe just notice the feeling of your clothes, the texture of the table. Pick up an object and feel its shape and temperature. Or intentionally notice a smell in the room. It gently nudges those dopamine-driven curiosity circuits back online.
Small steps. And what about activating play? That seems like the opposite of threat.
Play is the ultimate sign of safety, really. It says, I have surplus energy. I feel secure enough to be spontaneous. To gently invite play, you can introduce tiny cues. Maybe letting the corners of your mouth turn up in a slight spontaneous smile, even if you don't feel like it initially. Or a small non-purposeful movement, like a gentle stretch or wiggle. It signals to the system that connection and ease are possible.
Now, the sources really emphasize something crucial here. None of this fancy sensory input works well if the system is already totally overwhelmed or depleted. We need base safety.
Absolutely critical. Base safety isn't optional. It's the foundation. It's establishing a reliable home port of physiological regulation. If your nervous system is constantly jacked up on high alert, it literally cannot process or integrate these subtle MMPM correction signals. It's too busy surviving.
So building base safety is about creating predictability and stability for the nervous system.
Exactly. Predictable rhythms are key. Aiming for consistent sleep-wake times, regular meals, finding some kind of consistent movement you enjoy. It's also about having reliable sensory anchors throughout the day. Simple things like consciously feeling your feet on the ground or resting a hand on your belly for a moment.
Grounding techniques.
Yes. These things help keep the system more consistently in that calmer ventral vagal state, which then allows it to actually learn from the new data you provide during those MMPM moments. You need a safe harbor to return to.
Okay, we've got the theory, the different systems, the practical techniques. Let's talk about the proof. Does neuroscience actually back up this idea that we can retrain these deep subcortical systems through sensory input?
It absolutely does. The idea of predictive coding isn't just theoretical anymore. Research, like work by Tabas and others from around 2020, has demonstrated that even very early sensory pathways in the subcortex.
Like before information even fully reaches the thinking brain.
Exactly. Even those early relay stations for hearing or seeing, they generate their own predictions about incoming signals, and they update based on errors, based on surprise.
That's huge. It means learning, real biological adaptation, is happening way below the level of conscious thought or language. The subcortex learns from the patterns it detects.
It learns from the statistics of sensory input. And when we look specifically at threat processing, it's not just one brain area, like the amygdala, working alone. It's a whole network.
What are the key players in that network that MMPM is trying to influence?
Well, you've got the amygdala, which flags emotional significance. Is this important? Is it potentially threatening?
Mm-hmm.
You have the insula, which is crucial for interoception, sensing your internal body state, like your heart rate, your gut feelings.
Okay, the detector and the internal body sensor. What else?
Then you have the higher level regions that are meant to regulate the response. Key ones are the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, involved in conflict monitoring and attention, and especially the medial prefrontal cortex, MPSC.
The MPFC, that's kind of the executive control center for emotions, the brake pedal.
That's a good way to think of it. The MPFC receives the alert signals from the amygdala and the body state info from the insula, and its job is ideally to assess the context and regulate the response, either apply the brakes or signal all clear, or sometimes, yes, allow mobilization if needed.
And studies show these areas directly influence our physical state.
Absolutely. Work by Wager and others, for instance, showed how activity in these cortical and subcortical areas directly mediated changes in heart rate and blood pressure during social stress. Eisenbarth's research showed you could predict moment-by-moment changes in heart rate based on activity patterns in the MPFC and ACC.
So it's this constant conversation between brain and body, prediction and response.
A continuous loop. The brain regions are literally involved in calibrating the body's response.
If MMPM is about improving that calibration, improving the body's regulation, what's the best way to measure if it's actually working, objectively?
The gold standard measure here is heart rate variability, or HRV.
HRV. Okay, explain that, because it sounds technical and maybe counterintuitive. Doesn't a steady heart rate mean you're calm?
Actually, no. That's a common misconception. Think about it. A healthy system needs to be adaptable, flexible. A heart that beats with machine-like regularity is actually a sign of rigidity, often indicating stress or poor health.
The variability is good.
Yes. High HRV means there are subtle, healthy fluctuations in the time between each heartbeat. It reflects a nervous system that can quickly adapt, speed up when needed, slow down when resting. It shows good vagal tone, good autonomic flexibility. It's like having smooth control over the accelerator and the brake.
And low HRV.
Low HRV indicates the system is more stuck, less adaptable. It's strongly correlated with chronic stress, anxiety, depression, poor emotion regulation. The system is kind of locked in one gear, usually a stressed gear.
Wow. So this really drives home the point that feeling chronically unsafe might not be a thinking problem as much as an autonomic calibration problem.
That's a fantastic way to put it. The nervous system's flexibility is compromised, and research backs this up. Studies show that higher baseline HRV is linked to better fear extinction, meaning learning that something previously scary is now safe. Practicing MMPM aims to directly improve this autonomic flexibility. Increased HRV is a tangible sign that the system is learning safety.
This ties into the neurovisceral integration model, right?
It does. That model, proposed by Thayer and Lane, basically describes how those higher brain regions, particularly the MPFC and ACC, are structurally and functionally connected to the heart via the vagus nerve. Their job is to regulate the autonomic nervous system, including heart rate.
So better communication between the CEO, brain regions, and the body's systems equals better regulation.
Precisely. And MMPM, by creating these repeated experiences of activation plus safety, is thought to strengthen those pathways. It's like exercising the connection between the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system.
You're improving the top-down regulation by providing better bottom-up information.
You're facilitating integration. The subcortex gets coherent data. This sensation can happen with safety, and the cortex integrates that new meaning, strengthening its ability to regulate future responses.
And just to circle back the specific tools MMPM uses, breath, touch, gaze, tone, these aren't random, are they? They have direct lines to the control centers.
Absolutely not random. They are chosen because they directly engage the brainstem autonomic nuclei. These are the ancient control centers in the brainstem, like the nucleus ambiguous and the dorsal nucleus of the vagus, that physically control heart rate deceleration, breathing, and aspects of the fear response.
So using a slow exhale isn't just relaxing psychologically, it's physically stimulating the brake hardware in the brainstem.
Exactly. You're bypassing conscious thought and speaking directly to the oldest layer of regulation in its native physiology.
Okay, theory, proof. Let's get intensely practical now. Give us the steps. How does someone listening actually do this MMPM thing in daily life? And you mentioned, crucially, practice this when the activation is mild, right? Not in a full-blown panic attack.
Yes, that's really important. Think of it like building muscle. You start with lighter weights. You practice this during moments of slight unease, subtle tension, low-level worry. It's about building the habit of recalibration through repetition.
Okay, what's the first step?
Step one. Notice the flicker. This sounds simple, but it requires tuning in. It means catching the very first subtle somatic sign of a shift towards defense or unease.
Before the story kicks in.
Ideally, yes.
Yeah.
Before your mind labels it, I'm anxious or this is bad. What does that flicker feel like in your body? A tiny clench in your jaw. A slight shallowing of breath. A subtle warmth rising in your chest. A little knot in your stomach. That physical sensation is the subcortical prediction starting to activate.
So it's shifting attention from the content of the worry to the physical sensation of the shift.
Precisely. That's the moment of awareness. Once you notice that flicker, that physical change, you immediately move to step two, introduce a counter signal.
Okay, bring in the safety data. Remind us of the top choices again.
If it feels like tension, anxiety, fear, The slow, extended exhale is often the quickest win. Breathe in normally, then breathe out slowly, gently, maybe twice as long as the inhale. If it feels more like emptiness, loneliness, panic, grief, try placing a gentle, warm hand on your chest or sternum. Or even try that soft, low humming sound for a few seconds. If you feel scattered or hyper-focused, try expanding your gaze, soften your eyes, take in the whole room visually.
Okay, so notice the flicker, bring in a counter signal. Now the crucial integration part, step 3.
Step 3, let the data integrate. This is where the magic happens, and it goes against our usual instinct to fight or fix unpleasant feelings. The instruction is very clear. Do not try to push the original feeling away.
Don't try to make the tight stomach go away.
No. Instead, your job is to simply hold both sensations in your awareness simultaneously. Feel the tight stomach and feel the warmth of your hand on your chest. Notice the rapid heart rate and notice the slow exhale. Hold both together gently for about 15 to 30 seconds.
Why that specific time frame, 15, 30 seconds?
It seems to be long enough for the nervous system, especially the subcortical parts, to actually register the conflicting data, to process the prediction error. It's giving the system time to absorb the new reality. Okay, this activation signal is present, and this powerful safety signal is also present at the same time. Therefore, the activation itself doesn't automatically equal immediate danger.
You're decoupling the sensation from the automatic threat response.
Exactly. You're allowing the system to learn, through direct experience, a new association.
And the real benefit comes from doing these little loops consistently, daily, accumulating the micro-corrections.
That's the key. It's not about one dramatic intervention. It's about accumulating hundreds, thousands of these tiny moments where the system learns activation plus safety. Okay? It gradually rewires the default prediction. Hashtag outcomes and outro. And when you practice this consistently, the cumulative effect is profound. You're not just managing symptoms. You're actually helping to rewrite the underlying programming. The fear system starts to learn, okay, my heart can beat fast sometimes, and I'm actually safe.
The panic system learns stillness doesn't mean abandonment.
Precisely. Or that internal ache can be met with self-soothing, with warmth. It shifts the fundamental interpretation of internal cues.
And as we discussed, these aren't just subjective changes. There's measurable objective evidence of this recalibration happening.
Absolutely. You often see that measurable increase in HRV, indicating better autonomic flexibility, better vagal tone. You might notice a reduced baseline level of sympathetic arousal, feeling less wired generally, recovering from stress faster.
And in life,
people report feeling more present in relationships, less likely to automatically shut down or withdraw. Sleep often improves, both falling asleep and staying asleep. And neurologically, the evidence points towards strengthened prefrontal limbic connectivity, better communication between the thinking brain and the feeling brain.
So this whole deep dive really points towards a significant shift in how we understand ourselves, doesn't it? We're not just victims of our biology, condemned to repeat old patterns.
Right.
But we also can't just think our way into feeling safe and regulated when those deep systems are alarmed.
Exactly. It's about honoring the wisdom of the body and the insights from pioneers like Panksepp, Solms, Damasio, Porges. Understanding that deep architecture lets us finally engage with it effectively.
Using its own language.
Using its own language. MMPM offers a practical way to do that, using simple tools, breath, touch, gaze, movement, to provide the corrective sensory experiences the nervous system needs to learn deep down that safety is possible. Right here, right now.
So for everyone listening, as you take this understanding forward, maybe the final thought to explore is this. How do you shift from feeling ruled by these powerful, ancient emotional engines, the constant alarms, the old reactions, to becoming instead a wise steward of them? How can you gently, consistently guide your own nervous system day by day using these simple practices to learn the embodied truth of safety and build genuine, flexible resilience?
It starts with noticing that flicker, that first tiny sensation.
Yeah.
That's your entry point.